Good morning, everyone. We're going to go to open up the Senate Judiciary Committee. We're going to continue. We're in work sessions on two bills that were carried over and actually posted for today. And I'm going to make certain everyone is on the same page. Neither of those two bills are moving today at this time. And I do have the two individuals that were scheduled to give testimony on Tuesday on Senate Bill 1007, and we're going to take that testimony at this time. What I'm going to do is Scott Taylor has made arrangements. He was in Texas and was going to be with us by phone due to some technical difficulties and miscommunications. We did not have the conference call line set up. He is available today, but he's on a limited schedule because he has to be back for meetings in Portland. So Scott and Dave, did you want to come up as well? Scott, if you'll come on up and we'll get you on and out so you can take care of your other business. I want to thank you for making arrangements to be here this morning. I know it was on short notice, and we apologize that we left you standing close to some phone in Texas. Where were you in Texas?
Austin.
Austin, well, that's a nice place to be standing by a phone.
Thank you. Chair Przanski, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Scott Taylor. I'm the director of the Multnomah County Department of Community Justice, and I'm testifying today on behalf of the Oregon Association of Community Corrections Directors. As personal background, I'm currently the president-elect of the American Probation and Parole Association. I've served as assistant director of the Oregon Department of Corrections, both in community corrections and institutional programs. I've served as a correctional consultant for the National Institute of Corrections, with expertise in reentry, evidence-based practices, and community corrections. As community corrections director, there is considerable benefit to having inmates return to the community who have participated in prison programs. While with DOC, I worked on the Oregon accountability model and improved reentry. This work continues today as we improve the connection from institution to the community. The use of similar risk tools, case plans, and reach-in and reach-out efforts by the community corrections and DOC continue to improve public safety. Those inmates who show a desire to learn skills, act appropriately during incarceration, and develop quality release plans consistently perform on a whole better. I believe the use of earned time is one of the incentives to encourage inmates to take the first steps to change their behavior while incarcerated. The Oregon accountability model is designed to engage inmates in behavior that was constructive and would lead to the institution safety and long-term crime reduction through changed behavior and thinking. The handout that we've just given you, we gathered from the National Conference of State Legislatures, and this is a special report, Cutting Corrections Costs, Earned Time Policies for State Prisons. And within that document, you can read about a variety of the states and special projects that are going on. Overall, I believe they cite 31 states that currently use earned time, good time. And they have a study in there, and near the end, I believe on page 4 and 5, that talks about report they looked at, that looked at 13 reports and found none showed an increase in recidivism through the use of good time, and that in fact some found a decrease, and it cites some specific states in there. Also near the back of that report is an appendix that has all the states laid out, so you can see the different types of good time they give. They also note in there that the economic savings were also noted in several states. We can talk about that. Holding the inmate accountable for the crime and their behavior in the institution is what the Oregon Accountability Model accomplishes today. The ability to motivate change in thinking and behavior can lead to reduction in recidivism and future victims has been proven over and over as an evidence-based principle that we adhere to as we try to apply Senate Bill 267. And that's all I have.
All right. Questions? Thank you.
Thank you.
All right, and the last person we had scheduled for the last hearing was Ann Pratt. And Ann, if you want to come forward.
Good morning, Chair Przanski and members of the committee. My name is Ann Pratt, and I'm with Crime Victims United. I did turn in written testimony on Tuesday, but would like to share a few words with you also. And with my written testimony, I turned in some testimony from Joan and Art Oquist, who are from Washington, but lost their daughter 3 years ago in a DUI homicide. I also have the testimony of Janet Lovelace that I forgot to bring on Tuesday. I hope I can still submit that.
Right.
Thank you. Working as a victim advocate for the last 10 years has had many challenges, but none as challenging as the 3508 hearings. I worked with several victims who were forced to revisit violent crimes committed against them or their families. I found they all had a common denominator, fear. Fear of retaliation, fear that if they revisited the crime, they would not be able to recover the ground that they had made since the crime, or that their families would be split wide open again. The Mary Thompson case is the one that stands out for me, the gang mom who ordered the death, the hit, murder of Aaron Itura in 1994. She ordered two teenage gang members to kill him in his home. Janice Itura, the mother of the victim, Aaron Itura, decided to fight the extra 10%. She had been convicted of murder, 6 hindering prosecution, and 1 burglary. This crime is 15 years old. Janice said it was like ripping off the scab and reopening the wound. Judge Vogt denied it and said this to Ms. Itura: "I think a system of justice that forces victims through a process like this, when they are victims of violent and heinous crimes, is a broken system of justice. I apologize on behalf of that system." There's also a letter to the editor that appeared in our paper written by Ms. Itura attached to my statement, my written statement. Other cases include the Marion County terrorist, Christopher Millis, who in 05 shot at his neighbors, police officers, and also crashed into and set fire to the Marion County courthouse. Many victims were involved in that case, and it cost Marion County close to $14 million, and the courthouse was closed for a year. There was a change of venue, so that was also heard in Lane County. Judge Vogt denied that case, saying, "The sentences subject to consideration for reduction were all crimes of violence being committed in conjunction with crimes of even more violence." I also spoke to a mother whose daughter was groomed into prostitution. That victim was terrified the offender would come out and come after her because she had to testify against him again. The mere sound of his voice in the courtroom that day has sent her backwards. This one hit me personally. My son-in-law is a law enforcement officer in the Eugene-Springfield area. His offender was convicted of assault on a police officer, felon in possession, theft one, and 3 ID thefts. All were eligible for an extra 10% earned time. What really happened and stands out in my mind is this offender tried to get a gun out of his pocket to use it on him. This officer went through the same emotions as many of the other victims, and the earned time was denied. I'm very grateful that most of these cases have been heard, and that brings us to the 30% earned time that is now in effect for those who are currently processed. I began lobbying back in 2001 against earned time. Back then it was about inmate control. I have fought alongside others who believed in good public safety in every session since to keep earned time at 20%. I never thought that this would really happen. When all is tallied, considering the monetary cost to the counties, the processing for processing these 4,500 cases, the cost to the state for indigent defense, the pain and the suffering to the victims, not to mention the cost of new crimes and new victims, I believe that we will find that it was not at all worth it. There are new crimes and new victims. Demetrius Payton, a registered sex offender and burglar from the Portland area, received 55 days early release and has been already arrested for burglary and sexual assault. No one chooses to be a victim, but criminals choose to be criminal. And 20% earned time is more than enough, is fair incentive and consideration for good behavior and inmate control, especially for those who have already proven themselves to be violent felons. An increasing earned time from 20 to 30% drastically reduces truth in sentencing and public safety. I urge you to repeal the 10% earned time portion of House Bill 35. Thank you for this opportunity to speak.
Questions?
Ms. Pratt, I do have one. I have one question based on you bringing up Demetrius Payton. Did you know, based on the report that was in the paper and what I've been able to get from the Department of Corrections, that the new crime that he committed was after his release date on the 20%, and it did not occur between that window of the additional 10%?
No, I did not.
So basically, my understanding from the stuff we received from the Department of Corrections, that the individual was slated to get out on November 26 under the 20% rule, that it was accelerated to October 2nd, so he did get out earlier than the 20% rule, but the crime that he is accused of now did not occur until January. So it would have occurred and did occur after he was released on the 20% as compared to being in that window, the extra 10%.
Sorry for that inaccuracy.
All right, thank you. Any other questions, comments? Thank you very much.
Oh, I just have you're going to close the hearing here momentarily, right?
I was looking for Mr. Harker. I know Doug was here earlier because I wanted to ask him a question that has come up.
I just wanted to comment on the bill briefly, Mr. Chair.
Okay, why don't you go ahead. Was this for Ms. Pratt?
No.
And you can step back.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Chair, just for the record, I want to make sure that it was on the record that I did make comments to all the committee members by email, as you know, and with the approval of the Secretary of the Senate, and I appreciate no one sending a bulk email back because that would have violated our rules, but I did want to ensure that they were put on the record, and I believe staff has a copy of it. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Doug, I'm sorry to get to say something to you before, but a concern has come up based on an article that was in today's paper in the Oregonian. I don't know if you saw it regarding...
Don't take the Oregonian, Senator.
I normally don't either, but sometimes people bring stuff to my attention. And then Ann Pratt just talked about Demetrius Payton, and there's comments in the Oregonian that said that you did not know that Payton's original release date was prior to his committing the new crime. And so the question that has been raised to me is if the ad that is running from Oregon Anti-Crime Alliance is giving misinformation, what's going to happen with that ad?
Senator Prozanski, members of the committee, my name is Doug Harkelrode for the record. I'm the retired Lane County District Attorney, and I represent the Oregon Anti-Crime Alliance. I don't know the answer to that question about the ad. What I do know that the ad was based on an article from the Oregonian, which indicated that Mr. Demetrius, and I don't remember the last name, was released under this earned time law. I'll ask that question later today at a meeting. I talked to Susan Goldsmith, I think is the writer of that article, yesterday on the telephone. She called and asked, not exactly that question, but indicated she had checked on some dates, and she said, in essence, where's your information come from? And my response was, it comes from your newspaper, in an article in your newspaper written by Maxine somebody on January 14th, and actually had a copy of the information, so I read her what the article said, which was pretty clear that they had indicated that this Demetrius fellow was released early under the 3508 section 17. So I don't know the answer to your question. I'll figure that out later today.
What I'm going to do is I'll get you a copy or have staff give you a copy of what we received from the Department of Corrections that states as to when he was released under the 30-day or 30% and when he was scheduled to be out on the 20%, and that the crime that he's accused of occurred sometime after what would have been his 20% release date. So it wasn't within that window of opportunity. And I know that everyone has high emotions
spirited, but we also want to make certain that information going out to the public is as accurate as it can be.
Sure, I'll be happy to take the information. If I could get that when the committee is done today, that'd be great.
Yeah, and the other reason I want to say that is because there's a posting, and one of the members has given to me that one of the postings that's come in from the comments from the general public, who basically are reacting to the ad, basically says, "I hope that lawmakers know that if one of these inmates get out early, hurts my family, I will personally hurt yours." You get that, lawmakers? Your vote does matter. So we want to make certain there's accurate information going out to the general public, please.
And obviously, well, maybe not obviously, I don't agree with that comment.
I know you don't. After working for you for over 4 years, I know you don't. All right.
So if I can have all of that, that'd be helpful to me as soon as the committee is done meeting today.
Okay, thank you very much.
Sure, you're welcome.
All right. We're going to go ahead and close the work session at this time for Senate Bill 1007. And we're going to go ahead and go into our public hearing on Senate Bill 1049. And again, I want to make another announcement for those who weren't here at the very beginning. Senate Bill 1008 that we heard testimony on Tuesday is being carried over until Monday of next week. So 1008 is carried over, and realize that is in a work session. Gosh, it looks like you might have, were you here for that bill? Ms. McKee?
No, I'm sorry. No,
Well, you started to grab your bag, so
no, I was about to leave.
Okay. have it your way. Okay. So we'll open up the public hearing on Senate Bill 1049. I also want to make certain we had it scheduled for a possible work session. Because we do not have the complete amendments done, we will not be moving that bill today. So today is only public hearing, Senate Bill 1049. And in that public hearing, and we will bring forward Richard Whitman and whoever else you'd like to have in your panel. Oh, of course.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 1049 amends ballot measure 49 in three ways. Allows those who file claims only with the county to be eligible for one dwelling. Allows who failed to provide an adequate appraisal or an appraisal to be eligible for one dwelling. Allows those that acquired property between 1975 and the date of the county's land use regulation to be eligible for up to three dwellings depending on the acreage and the local zone at the time the property was acquired. Charges a fee of $2,500 for certain claims. Clarifies transferability to family members, clarifies Department of Land Conservation and Development standing in litigation, declares emergency effective on passage. There is a -1 amendment that we expected that we would have today. We don't have it. It just replaces the words "this subsection" on page 2, line 4, with the words "subsection 1." And this change was requested by DLCD, and we're expecting to have that today, and we'll get the fiscal on that -1 as soon as possible. Thank you, Mr. Chair. There is a fiscal statement issued with this bill, by the way.
Okay, thank you. Richard?
Good morning, Chair Przanski and members of the committee. My name is Richard Whitman. I'm the director of the Department of Land Conservation and Development. I have with me today Judith Moore, who is the division manager for the Measure 49 division in the department, and also Virginia Gustafson, who is the assistant attorney in charge of the Natural Resources section in Oregon Department of Justice, and who works closely with the department on the implementation of ballot measure 49. Your staff have already given you a brief summary of the bill. I'm just going to give the committee very briefly some context for this legislation so they understand where it's coming from and what it's intended to do. Take you back to ballot measure 49, which amended the earlier ballot measure 37, providing compensation to property owners whose property was, the use of their property was restricted by a land use regulation and the value of that property reduced. Measure 49 provided for limited relief in the form of authorization for home sites for claimants under measure 37. We are, and the department was given the responsibility of implementing Measure 49. There were about 4,600 claims that were filed under Measure 37 / Measure 49. We made a commitment in the last legislative session to complete the work on implementing ballot Measure 49 by the end of June of this year. I'm pleased and proud to report this morning that we are, in terms of getting preliminary decisions out, about 83% of the way through the work on implementing ballot measure 49. And we fully expect to meet the commitment that we made to the legislature in the last session. In the last session, there was legislation related to Measure 49, House Bill 3225, which made a series of amendments to Measure 49 and allowed some claimants who did not qualify under Measure 49 to come back into the process to get an authorization for a home site. There were two groups of claimants who were discussed during the last session who were not taken care of, if you will, in House Bill 3225. Instead, the department, and specifically the Measure 49 Ombudsman, was directed to prepare a report for the legislature on those two groups of claimants as to how many were in those groups and why they were in the situation they were in. That report was delivered to the legislature at the end of December of last year. And the two groups are, the first group is claimants who, under Measure 37, only filed a claim with a county. They failed to file a claim with the state of Oregon. And as a result, under the terms of Measure 49, did not qualify for relief. There are about, since we have never seen those claims, we do not have an exact figure, but based on the investigation that the Ombudsman did, we expect that there are about 900 of those claimants. The second group of claimants are claimants that did elect under Measure 49 and were proceeding, but were proceeding under the part of Measure 49 that allowed a greater authorization for development on their property, up to 10 dwelling units, if they could prove a reduction in value of their property as a result of a land use regulation. Measure 49 provided that if those claimants failed to provide that proof, then they had a period of time in which they could come down under the part of Measure 49 that provided up to 3 home sites. But if they failed to elect down, if you will, during that time frame, then they're out of luck. They don't get anything. So we have about 90 claimants who are in that situation who were seeking a greater amount of relief under Measure 49, but who failed to prove a reduction in value as a result of a land use regulation. And the Ombudsman report also addresses that group of claimants. So the first two purposes of this legislation before you today, Senate Bill 1049, are to provide some limited relief to each of those two groups of claimants. The concept was discussed again a bit during the last legislative session, but we wanted to have a better sense of how many claimants were in these groups and why they were in these categories. And just briefly, with regard to the county-only claimants, the reason we have about 900 people in that situation is we did have several counties that were advising property owners that they did not need to file a claim with the state of Oregon. And that appears to have been the primary cause of that situation. There was litigation between the state and those counties over that issue, over the, whether or not a claim had to be filed with the state of Oregon as well as the county, and that litigation was resolved with the courts deciding that yes, in fact, you do have to file a claim with the state as well as the counties. But nevertheless, these 900 or so claimants failed to do so. So 1049 would provide a home site authorization for claimants in each of those two categories, so long as they otherwise comply with the basic requirements of Measures 37 and 49, which in the essential requirement being that they could have gotten a home on their property at the time that they acquired it. The third major part of Senate Bill 1049 addresses a group of claimants that are in the Measure 49 process who acquired their property between the time the statewide planning goals were adopted in 1975 and the date each county's land use regulations were acknowledged as complying with the statewide planning goals. There are about 700 of those claims. During that time period when they acquired their property, those claimants, in order to get a dwelling on their property, would have to show that they comply both with local zoning and with state land use planning goals. That analysis is very subjective, to be frank. The standards that were in place at that time are quite subjective, and that was not well understood by many property owners. So the third thing that 1049 would do is provide some clarity about how to treat those claims that are in that situation, so-called pre-acknowledgement situation, by providing a specific number of home sites are authorized based on the acreage that each property owner has. So those are the provisions of 1049, and I would be happy to answer any questions that the committee might have now that I have turned my phone off.
You did that so well, too.
Senator Westside.
Chair Brzezinski, first, the mea culpa, I have a claim that falls into the third category, the pre-acknowledgement category. So there's a potential conflict of interest.
So noted.
And Mr. Whitman, you didn't mention in your summary the $2,500 fee that some of these folks will be asked to pay in order to make that application. Does that only apply to the groups one and two?
Chair Senator Whitsitt, that is correct, and I apologize for not mentioning that. And so let me talk about that for just a second, if I might. There is a fee for the first two categories of claimants. That fee is set at an amount that based on the department's experience with actual cost of processing Measure 49 claims. The intent is to fully fund the work on those first two groups through the fee revenue. For the third group of claimants, the 700 pre-acknowledgement claims, they're already in the Measure 49 process. The legislature has already provided general fund funding for the processing of those claims. So no, the fee does not apply to those claimants.
Thank you. And then your overview was fairly high level. Could you go into a little more detail on each of those categories on what a successful claimant could expect to receive in the way of how many house placements or home placements or whatever? As you probably understand, that for a layperson, that bill is very difficult to read.
Chair Brzezinski, Senator Whitsitt, it is complicated and a little difficult. So let me drill down a little bit more and explain for each of the categories how that works a little bit more specifically. So as I mentioned, for those first two categories of claimants, Senate Bill 1049 would authorize an additional dwelling. That's regardless of how many dwellings the property owner may have on their property already. They would get one more under if they fall into that category, either of those categories. And again, those being county-only, Measure 37 filing, and what we call Section 7 conditional filing under Measure 49, but failed to prove loss in value. They would all get one dwelling regardless. For the third category, and this is where it gets a little more complicated, the authorization is for a home site authorization, and that's a term of art under Measure 49, if you will. And what it means is that the number of dwellings that are allowed on the property are set based on taking into consideration any dwellings that already exist on the property. So let me give you an example to clarify. If a property owner has no dwellings on their property right now, then they can get, under the term, this third part, up to three dwellings on their property. That's the standard Measure 49 provision. However, if the property owner already has one dwelling on their property, they'll get two more, so they get a total of three. And if they have two dwellings on their property, they'll get one more. There is a provision in Measure 49 that provides if they already have three dwellings on their property, they get a bonus, so they would get one more. That's the way that Measure 49 was put together originally. That's not new under 1049. That's the original concept. That is not changed by 1049. It's the same approach in that regard. Does that answer your question, Senator?
Yes, thank you.
Yeah.
Any questions?
Mr. Just to make sure I don't have a, or I do or don't have a conflict of interest, which I don't know at this point, but could you just expand the, says staff measure says clarifies transferability to family members, and I read section 3. Can you just kind of give me a layman's term?
Yes, Senator, Chair Prezansky, Senator Boquist. One of the, as you all know, one of the main points of contention under Measure 37 was the transferability of the relief provided there. Measure 49 clarified that relief under Measure 49 is transferable.
Okay.
However, it also provided that once the claimant transfers the property, that authorization has to then be used within a 10-year period. So this provision that's in Senate Bill 1049 would amend that slightly to provide that if the claimant transfers the property to another family member and retains an undivided interest in the property, that would not trigger that 10-year period. The 10 years wouldn't be triggered until the subsequent transfer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Any disclaimers or anything at this point?
Mr. Chair, you were involved in the whole thing, and you looked surprised a minute ago, so I don't have a clue. I will just state for the record, I did have a Measure 49 claim, and I don't know whether this impacts it or not.
Just
and I don't
on the
think
record.
The,
I think
the be department chair would have a clue either if I gave him the situation.
No, that's just all right.
May
any other questions or comments for this panel?
Mr. Chair, I just want to point out we received letters from Larry Durr, and I don't know if the department wants to put on the record their response to Mr. Durr's letters. I know he had some questions about the third category.
Yes. So, I actually, do you want to handle this one?
Sure. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Virginia Gustafson, Assistant Attorney General of the Department of Justice Natural Resources Section. I did have a conversation yesterday with Dave Honeycutt, who had questions about Mr. Durr's letter. And after the conversation, Mr. Durr clarified his letter and submitted the second letter. He was concerned that, as I understood his first letter, that the zone that would be evaluated under his pre-acknowledgement claim would be that zone which was ultimately acknowledged by the state as being in compliance with the goals. And that is, in fact, not correct. Senate Bill 1049 does not change the evaluation of what was lawfully permitted at the time a claimant acquired the property. And I believe Mr. Durr's subsequent letter expresses an understanding of that. If it doesn't, in fact, 1049 does not propose to change any of the lawfully permitted analysis. If property was acquired that was subject to zoning, then the claimant is held to that zoning, that which they could have relied on at the time they, by the county, at the time they acquired the property. The exception there is if it was less restrictive, they can get up to 3 home sites depending on the acreage. But if the property was zoned at a more restrictive zoning at the time they acquired the property, they're held to that. So for example, if the property owner had 30 acres or zoning that was 30 acre minimum at the time they acquired, under the legislation, because they have and they had 40 acres, under the legislation they could have gotten 2, but because the zoning in effect at the time they acquired allowed them only to have 1, they would be held to that. And again, this does not change the existing analysis under 49.
Senator Wissett?
We have a further question. If a person acquired a property in the Class 3 category after the goals were adopted but before the county had created a comprehensive plan.
And at a later time, something like a
overlay was established on that property or on that area. If I heard you correctly, that would not bear on the evaluation of the property, because at the time that the property was acquired, there was no such restriction.
Chair Prusansky, Senator Whitsitt, that's correct. The only subsequently adopted land use regulations that would continue to apply to that home site authorization are, and this is under Measure 49, are basically health and safety regulations. But something like a mule deer winter range overlay would not affect the right of the property owner to go ahead and develop that dwelling on the property.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Senator Boquist. A can of worms, Mr. Chair. The third portion, which is the portion, again, between 1975 and the date the county land regulation is eligible, there are two or three counties in it that I'm aware of that had this happen to them in that dime period, where the statewide goals came out, the county adopted the plan. That was the plan at the time, which allowed dwellings, for whatever reason, to be eligible in certain parcels. And then they were taken to court, and then the court changed, in the court settlement, or the court change directed by the court, it changed some of those parcels from, for example, Ag 20 to Ag 80, which then eliminated the right under the new plan that was adopted by the court or forced upon them by the court. Okay, so how does that fit into this third category?
Chair Prusansky, Senator Boquist, great question, because that's a good example of this third category and why we're doing what we're doing with Senate Bill 1049. So during this period, the so-called pre-acknowledgement period, a property owner, in order to get a dwelling on their property, had to comply with local zoning. Everybody understands that. There's no question about it. They also, and the part that a lot of people do not understand, is that property owner also had to comply with state law until the county's plan was acknowledged as complying with state law. They basically had to comply with two things, and whichever was stricter. And so the provisions in the third part of Senate Bill 1049 are our, and when I say our, I don't mean just the department, but working together with Oregonians in Action and Thousand Friends, our best effort to simplify what was allowed under state law during that time. So claimants will still have to meet local zoning, as Ms. Gustafson just described. And then for purposes of complying with state law, they'll have to meet these acreage requirements. And in some cases, the county zoning may be stricter than this, in which case the county zoning will control. In some cases, the acreage provisions that are in 1049 may be stricter. It'll depend.
Clarification. So remember, I'm the non-lawyer here, the non-lawyer side over here. So make sure I understand. So an example, if a county had an agricultural 20 zone, and at the time it was Ag 20, the county plan allowed to it, but the county plan was not acknowledged by the state because it was in court. They went in and applied to build on their Ag 20 partial, and then the final plan that was acknowledged after the court case was Ag 80, right? Does that fall into this category, or is it still in limbo land?
Chair Prusansky, Senator Boquist, it does fall into this category, and under that example, the local zoning at the time would be 28 Ag 20 zoning. So if somebody had 20 acres or more, they could put a dwelling on it. And under the provisions of 1049, it would essentially matches that. If they have 0 to 20 acres, they would be allowed one home site. 20 to 40, they'd be allowed two home sites. 40 plus, they'd be allowed three.
Okay. Yes, Mr. Chair, I have a conflict of interest.
All right. Now we flesh that out. We've been waiting.
We just want to make sure we're all on the record.
We're all on the record.
All righty.
Mr. Goodman, it's my understanding that the under Group 1, the significant number of claimants in Jackson County would be allowed, if their application fit the right criteria, would be allowed one additional home, and there would be a fee of $2,500 charged to them for that evaluation. Is that correct?
Chair Prusansky, Senator Whitsitt, that's correct.
Okay, thank
and,
you.
And Jack, based on the Ombudsman's investigation, Jackson County probably has the highest number of claimants in that category.
One additional home would be, regardless of whether there's already a home on the, it was just one additional home, period.
Chair Prusansky, Senator Whitsitt, that's correct.
Thank you.
Any other questions, comments? Thank you very much. Our next panel includes Dave Honeycutt, Steve McCoy, and I also have Connie Brander. If you'd like to come up as well. We got three chairs, and I usually... Oh, Representative Wingard, you're not on here, so I wasn't sure. This is your constituent? Let me do this, because I want to get the work group complete, if you have time, that is. And I'd like to go ahead and get them on the record, then we can bring you two up. Will that work, or do you need to go on to some other business?
I have a committee, but it's all right.
No, let's come on up, then.
I appreciate the excuse.
Come on up. No, we need you in a committee. So if you want to come on up, we'll have you up, and then we'll bring up the other two.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Representative Matt Wingard, House District 26, which includes a sprawling area of rural unincorporated Washington County, where my constituents, Rob and Connie Branders, live, and their situation falls under one of the three categories, actually the first one that the good director outlined in Senate Bill 1049. And I just wanted to thank the chair and the committee for following up on the bill that we passed last session. I was in the House Land Use Committee when some folks were left out of the process that moved forward in the last session, and this really matters to, I know it, you know, it's a relatively small group of folks relative to the overall population in Oregon, but for these folks, it, you know, in many cases it could be money they invested for their retirement in property. It's important to them, and I do appreciate the committee and the chairman making an effort in this special session to address this issue and move it forward.
Thank you. Good morning. My name is Connie Brander, and I'm speaking on behalf of my husband, Rob Brander. We are residing at 30800 Southwest Unger Road in Cornelius, Oregon. This land we purchased in 1993. It was zoned agricultural 4. Shortly after we purchased it, it was demoted to agricultural 5, and we lost one buildable lot on that. At that time, we consulted a land use attorney, David Smith, and he said it was possible to regain that lot back, but it would cost us several thousand dollars and quite a bit of time. So on that behalf, we continued to work with it and tried to go to Washington County and do some building, barns, pole barns, etc., which to no avail, we were not able to do that either. They said that we couldn't build a pole barn and house our equipment in that because it was something that they would not allow. Squatters' rights would ensue on that. So that was another issue that we were having difficulty with. So when Measure 37 came along in 2005, we were approved. The property was close to being partitioned off at that time when the Marion County judge revoked that Measure 37, and so that left us sitting once again. It was overturned, and Measure 49 came along and was approved by the voters. And on behalf of the senior planner of Washington County, Tom Harry, and his constituent, Jim Tice, they both agreed that since we were more than 1 mile from the urban growth boundary, that we did not need to file a Measure 49 claim with them. So we did not file a claim with Measure 49 to the state. 49 passed, so when I called to find out where our documents were with the state, apparently since we did not file, there were no packets. There was nothing coming our way. So that left us sitting once more, and we're not getting any relief under Measure 49 until maybe Senate Bill number 1049 passes for us. So 17 years later, we are still no closer to getting that extra lot that we purchased back in 1993. So on behalf of all the other property owners that are in the same situation we are, we hope that this measure will get passed. One of the things that we really aren't excited about is paying $2,500, though, to get our land rights back. But if that's something that has to be done, that's something that we'll do.
Thank you.
Questions?
Ms. Brander, one thing, I kind of worked with the two major parties, interest groups, Argonians in Action, as well as Thousand Friends. And I was part of the original group that did the drafting on 49. What we're attempting to do is make certain that some of the unintended consequences that did occur, including similar ones that you had, which really you had no relief under the state, and the obligation from my perspective was with the county not giving you the appropriate information, that we wanted to do what we could to try to assist, to give you, you know, some relief. The $2,500 was recognized as the cost to actually process the claims. And I know that it may be a burden for you and for others, but at this date and stage, based on what we've seen as to how some of the other claims, the cost and the processing that was had to be made up with other tax dollars, we felt that that was one component that was going to be required of those who wanted to claim, that they would have to pay for that kind of, as we would call it, a user fee. So I hope that you recognize that it's one of those things that we at this level and maybe at this time in our economic situation as a state aren't able to, let's say, subsidize the processing of the claim. And we do hope that you will be able to take advantage. I do expect 1049 to make it through this process, and hopefully at that time you and your husband can realize dreams that you've had for the last 17 years.
Yeah.
All right.
Can I ask a quick question, Mr. Chair? Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you. I just want to make sure, Ms. Brander, thank you for being here, that I understand what you said correctly. You said the Washington County planner told you didn't need to file the Measure 49 claim. But did you file with Washington County but did not file with the state, or did you not file at all?
We filed a Measure 37 claim with Washington County.
Okay.
And after that process, we conferred with Tom Harry out there at Washington County, and he told us that it was not something that we were required to do. We were outside the urban growth boundary by more than 1 mile, and they said that it was not necessary. He talked to one of his other colleagues there in the office, and they both looked through all the documentation, and they said that it was not necessary for us to do so.
Thank you for the clarification.
Yeah. And this is one of those things, when we looked at the, let's say, the population, the groups that were out there specifically on the what we call county-only filed, Washington County and Jackson County were the two that seemed to have significant numbers. We've already heard from the director as to some litigation that took place where the state actually challenged and was successful as to how Jackson County was handling this and the information they were giving to their constituents. And it's one of the things that, and I know that we here at the on the committee have had this conversation as to what obligations does the state have to, quote unquote, bail out a county when they give wrong information. And I will tell you, I don't think the state has any obligation, but we felt in this particular case, because of the scenarios that had played out, that it was something that we could do, and it may not be what you may have been able to receive, depending on your situation, as to the number of lots that could be billable. But we felt that getting something there would be better than nothing.
Right. We agree.
All righty. Any other comments? Thank you very much for coming forward. Was there anyone else who wanted to give testimony today on Senate Bill 1049?
And McCoy.
Oh, I'm sorry. We didn't have our other two. Mm-hmm. So Dave Honeycutt and Steve McCoy, if you two would please come forward. And besides those two, was there anyone else who wanted to give testimony today? Dave.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, Dave Honeycutt, Oregonians in Action, speaking in support of SB 1049. This, I think, closes the loop on 3225, on the two categories of claimants under 3225 that we that the legislature deferred to February, and also adds and clarifies a significant source of concern, calls that I get in my office all the time from people who bought post-adoption of the goals, post-January 75, but pre-acknowledgement of their local comprehensive plan, typically in the early 80s. There's, as Mr. Whitman indicated, a significant amount of ambiguity for property owners in that category right now. For those few claims that the department has decided for property owners in that category, most of those claimants are being denied. Under the process of Measure 49, if you get a denial in a final order, your avenue for relief is a circuit court action in the county in which your property is located, which, unless I can represent you, and I can't represent all the claimants in that category, means you're probably going to have to go out and hire a lawyer. And even if you're successful, some of those claims may be successful, some of them may not. The issue's in litigation now, but even if you were successful, the cost would far exceed the $2,500 fee that's being requested in this bill. So although we're not excited about the fee either, I think I believe that it's certainly less than what you would incur if you were, you know, in some of these categories, if you were out there having to litigate. The other thing, I think this is a good bill. It helps people. It doesn't provide them with all of the relief, but it gives them something. And there are a number of people out there who, without this bill, would get nothing. I talked to a lady yesterday, just to relay one story, and then I'll shut up, who acquired her one-acre property in Clackamas County in 1977. It was zoned rural residential at the time. Subsequent to that time, when the county first had its acknowledged comprehensive plan, the zoning was changed to exclusive farm use. As a result, she can't build a house on her one-acre property. This bill will give her the right to put a single-family dwelling on the one-acre property. That's what they wanted when they acquired it in 77. She's been fighting for 33 years to reacquire those rights, and the relief in her voice on the phone yesterday, thinking that if this bill passes, she's going to be able to put 33 years of stress and sleepless nights and sort of gnawing problems to bed, I think makes this bill worth it. It's a good bill. I thank the chair for his time spent with us on these efforts, and I hope this bill passes.
Steve.
Chair Przanski and members of the committee, I am Steve McCoy. I am with 1,000 Friends of Oregon, and thank you for the opportunity to testify in support of this bill. I think that the measures in there to help DLCD streamline processing of some claims are important. It's important that DLCD completes processing of the Measure 49 claims, obviously within the legislatively mandated timeline. The bill itself is, I think it's safe to say, a carefully wrought compromise, which we do support. It is, however, at the outside edge of what we're willing to support. And I urge you to pass the bill as introduced without substantive amendments.
Thank you. There, my understanding, there is one set of amendments that needed to be done for Scrivener's error. It's going to be there, but my understanding, there's no other substantive changes that will be made. Any questions for anyone on the panel?
Mr. Chair, I just want to thank 1,000 Friends of Oregon for participating in the process, because it's their lawsuit that got my conflict.
All right, and I want to thank both groups again for all of the work that their representatives put forward, and working with the department and getting, let's say, a hope closure for on this chapter of our land use laws in the state, and will in fact give the relief to some of these individuals that have been kind of caught in the middle of the conflicts and all that. So thank you all very, very much, and please take back to your organizations my gratitude for them to being able, one, come to the table, and two, be civil, and three, reach a resolution. Thank you. All right, I don't have anyone else that's scheduled to testify on Senate Bill 1049. I'm going to ask one more time if there's anyone else that wants to give testimony. Not seeing anyone come forward, we're going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 1049. and council. What else do we need to do besides?
Just as a note on Senate Bill 1049, you'll note on the staff measure summary, we do have a LFO recommending a subsequent referral to Ways and Means, so when we do pass that, that will be part of the motion.
Right. Dash one now, right? Dash one, or we have a dash two coming?
We have a dash one coming on 1049, but it's not available yet.
All right. And it's just Scrivener's?
It's that one I mentioned on, on the dash one, on the SMS.
All right. With that, then we're going to be concluding our work today, and I'm just going to do this just to make certain. I think we have time to do this, but we are carrying over the work sessions on Senate Bill 1007, 1008, and we will be carrying over the possible work session to for Monday, all three of these, Senate Bill 1049. Yes. So everything's carrying over.
Hey, Mr. Chair, I'd like my comments for 1008 that everybody got put in the record, too. Thank you.
All right. And if there's not anything else, I hope everyone has a good weekend as it comes forward after tomorrow and today. And we'll see everyone Monday morning. Oh, and regarding Monday morning, what I think we're going to do is go ahead and have our start time at 8:15.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, to battle.
For those that are traveling. All right, with that, we'll see everyone Monday morning, 8:15.